This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Day 87 of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. The Palestinian death toll nearing 22,000 people, most of them women and children. Israeli military kills over 300 Palestinian medical personnel and abducts at least 100 more as it pushes ahead with its genocide in Gaza. And Iran deploys one of its Navy destroyers to the Red Sea a day after the U.S. so-called task force in the region attacks Yemeni boats. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've turned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, as the world is celebrating the Gregorian New Year with fireworks and festivities, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are running for their lives and looking for shelter. The Palestinian death toll is approaching 22,000 people amid relentless Israeli bombing of residential areas. Regime's airstrikes have also left over 56,000 people wounded and more than 7,000 others missing. Some of the latest attacks hit residential buildings in Khan Yunis, killing at least 35 people. The southern city has also witnessed fierce clashes between resistance fighters and Israeli forces over the past several days. A number of Palestinians were also killed in central Gaza, where Israeli warplanes struck several refugee camps. Well, the military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has targeted Tel Aviv and its suburbs in response to Israel's deadly onslaught on Gaza. The Al-Qassam brigades launched a barrage of rockets, with Israeli sources reporting failed interception of the projectiles. The regime's ambulances were also reportedly dispatched to the damaged sites. Israeli regime says nearly 170 of its soldiers have been killed and almost 900 injured since the launch of the ground operation in Gaza. Palestinians say fatalities among invading troops are much higher and that the regime is hiding the real number. A video has gone viral showing a group of Palestinian doctors in Gaza singing the former official anthem of Palestine and their desire to defend their homeland amid Israeli genocide on the Gaza Strip. Doctors have refused to leave the Gaza Strip to help people as the coastal territory struggles with a critical healthcare situation due to the Israeli attacks. Regime's airstrikes have killed over 300 Palestinian medical personnel since October the 7th. Israel keeps in custody around 100 Palestinian medics, including chief physicians of hospitals in the northern Gaza Strip. The regime's strikes have destroyed dozens of hospitals, ambulances, and medical centers. Our correspondent in the besieged Gaza Strip, Moti Abu Musabeh, says hospitals in the Palestinian territory are overwhelmed by the increasing number of injuries as a result of Israeli bombings.
Hospitals of Gaza Strip became really trapped between the walk of the direct targeting pursued by the Israeli occupation forces and the hard place of the increasing numbers of the Palestinian casualties who overwhelming the Palestinian hospitals and the health facilities here in Gaza Strip, which are completely collapsed over the continuous Israeli airstrikes. And according to the latest updates from the Gaza government media office, we are talking about at least 312 Palestinian medical were killed by the Israeli occupation forces. In addition to that, we are talking about at least 100 Palestinian doctor and medical staff also were kidnapped by the Israeli occupation forces. In addition to that, we are talking about 23 Palestinian hospitals hospitals here in the Gaza Strip became out of service over the continuous Israeli attacks. In addition to that, we are talking about 104 Palestinian ambulances were destroyed completely by the Israeli occupation forces. So we are talking about continuous and deliberate, actually, Israeli attacks reaching and targeting the health sector here in Gaza Strip in a way that deepens the suffering of the Palestinian people. And
meanwhile, Israeli atrocities unabated all over the Palestinian territories. In the latest aggression, regime forces arrested tens of Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kandil brings us more.
The Israeli military insists on continuing and going on with arresting Palestinians on a daily basis. Early on Monday, Israeli forces have detained at least 32 Palestinians from across the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces had raided the village of Qatarne, West Ramallah. Israeli troops raided Nablus, Ramallah, Al-Biri, and Al-Khalil as well, and detained at least 32 Palestinians. During the arrest operation, of course, this means Israeli forces are storming Palestinians' homes, terrorizing the people, putting Palestinians in the rooms and interrogating them even before detaining those Palestinians. Also today, the Israeli forces have raided Jabal al-Mukabbar town, south al-Quds, and had detained the mother of the Palestinian martyr Ahmed Alayan. Ahmed Alayan was shot and killed by the Israeli forces on the 28th of December.
A senior official with Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says attacks on Israeli positions across the southern Lebanese borders will end only if the regime ends its onslaught against Palestinians in Gaza. Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says Israel's efforts to restore peace to the northern part of the occupied territories will be in vain unless attacks on civilians in Gaza stop completely. The cleric warned that Israel's refusal to end the war in Gaza would lead to further escalation and clashes with Hezbollah. The comments came after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the regime will do whatever it takes to restore calm to northern occupied Palestine, where settlers have either been displaced or live in constant fear of missile attacks by Hezbollah. Well, tensions remain high along Lebanon's southern border, where Israeli forces have shelled Tahr Harfa and Al-Jabin villages. Hezbollah resistance fighters have responded by hitting Israeli positions along the border in support of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh brings us more.
Now the Israelis have escalated their drone attacks in areas that are residential, basically, within the houses. We've seen the destruction of several houses, whether in Ayat al-Shab, Ayat al-Arun, Bint Jbeil, especially. These are the towns that witnessed very heavy clashes during the 2006 war. It seems that there's a certain vendetta for the Israelis, in addition to the fact that they are incapable of basically reaching military targets for Hezbollah. And this is why we see them destroying more residential houses day by day. It seems that Hezbollah is always keeping an eye on the movement of the Israelis, even in places where they think that they don't—they are not seen or not under the scrutiny of the resistance. And it seems that the Israelis are incapable of basically specifying where Hezbollah is able to observe them. Are they using drones? Are they using other capabilities? How are they able to know the movements of the Israeli soldiers? We heard from one of the reservists say that basically Hezbollah is hunting us down just like ducks, as if Hezbollah has always the upper hand. And so this is what we're looking at right now. But of course, as you know, with Hezbollah and all the resistance, it is more of a strategic battle for them.
The Iranian Navy's outboard destroyer has entered the Red Sea via the Bab al-Mandab Strait asserting its presence in the region. The Alborz has sailed into the Red Sea as Iran's 94th Fleet. This a day after Sana'a warned Washington that it bears full responsibility for the consequences of a deadly attack by the U.S. Navy in the Red Sea. The Yemeni military also stressed that such attacks will not stop their anti-Israel operations. On Sunday, the U.S. Central Command said its helicopters shot at Yemeni boats that were stopping a container ship, killing at least 10 people. In recent weeks, Yemeni armed forces have claimed responsibility for attacks on several Israeli-owned and Israel-linked ships in waters off of Yemen. The Yemeni army says the operations are in retaliation for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Yemen correspondent Yusuf Mowry says the presence of the U.S. and its Western allies in the Red Sea has turned it into a war zone.
They've turned the Red Sea into a war zone, into a fireball arena where nothing can unfold except chaos and destruction, which is exactly what happened the other day. And this is because of the presence of the U.S. Navy and other Western powers in the Red Sea. So I think Ansar Allah government, they are making a firm decision that not only the Middle East, but also the Red Sea needs to be cleared from all Western presence in order to secure a safe international shipping lane to every nation except that of the Israeli entity. As you have mentioned, Ansar Allah will continue to block and prevent Israeli-linked ships from crossing Bab el-Mandeb and from having access to the Red Sea, and that's specifically aimed at putting pressure on the West, putting pressure on the Israeli entity to end its genocide in Palestine. So I think the presence of the Iranian destroyer in the Red Sea is an indication that, first and foremost, Iran is not going to allow this, you know, it's not just going to sit and stand idle while a coalition force led by the U.S. forms to attack Yemen. And the second point is that, you know, Iran is going to support the Yemeni military's initiative when it comes to clearing the Red Sea from any hostile presence.
Well, the BRICS Economic Alliance is growing with Iran and some other countries officially joining it at the beginning of the new year. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, made the announcement during his weekly presser. He said the multilateral platform provided by BRICS provides Iran with more opportunities to boost its economic cooperation with other countries. Kanani said Iran has always made serious efforts to promote a multipolar world, and the country's full membership in the group is an outcome of those efforts. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Ethiopia have also become official members of the BRICS. The group was formed by Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It represents around 40% of the global population and a quarter of the world's gross domestic product. Well, let me cross over to New York, joined by activist and commentator Don DeBar. Don, your take on now expansion of BRICS with countries such as Iran and others entering. What does it mean in your perspective?
Well, first to you and everyone there, happy and healthy new year.
Same to you.
I mean, if you want to look at it just in terms of structure and, you know, the human population or the bulk of humanity that's involved, the BRICS, the original BRICS group of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. These were up-and-coming economies, you know, some pretty strong at the time of the, you know, grouping together of, you know, in the last decade or so. Now all booming. If you look, for example, at Asia as sort of the center of the global economy now and cementing that, you have Russia, India, and China involved in this. Not just that. In Asia, you also have Russia as a member of the Eurasian Economic Union, which has Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan involved. You have China as the head of the Belt and Road Initiative and a member of a number of other multilateral economic and integrative organizations. You have Brazil as a member, and Latin America as a member of CELAC also, for example. And there's an entire structure of multilateralism going on in Latin America, CARICOM, Mercosur, et cetera, and in Africa. So they start with the African Union. There are a number of regional groupings also around South Africa, and South Africa is not the only large economy in Africa either. You have Nigeria, for example. The potential makes Atlantic grouping or whatever, the United States, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, and occupied Korea, it's going to dwarf it, maybe within a generation, certainly, maybe by the end of the this decade. And so as BRICS expands, it expands not just with the added members, but with the added networks of, associations of economic activity, economic groupings, where it's already encompassing maybe 60 to 70% of humanity and growing.
Thanks so much for being with us out of New York. Don DeBoer, activist and commentator. Moving on to other news now this hour. People in the Turkish city of Istanbul have taken to the streets on the first day of the new year in protest of the ongoing Israeli onslaught against Palestinians. Thousands of protesters gathered at the Galata Bridge, waving flags and chanting slogans in solidarity with Palestinians. Rallies were held in other cities across the globe on New Year's Eve, with protesters demanding a ceasefire in Gaza during the New Year celebrations. Mass rallies were also held in the Jordanian capital of Amman and the Lebanese capital of Beirut, also in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Hundreds of people marched in support of their fellow Palestinians. And in Berlin, pro-Palestine activists boycotted New Year's celebrations. A global campaign has called on people around the world to turn the New Year's countdown into a countdown for ceasefire in the besieged Gaza Strip. In the U.S. cities of Boston and New York, thousands of people ended 2023 with pro-Palestine rallies instead of taking part in New Year celebrations.
The world is celebrating 2024, and Gaza, now after 87 days, and the bombing did not even stop. So it's a genocide that's keep going and going and going, And the whole world is silent. And this is a shame, really, The U.S. is supposed to stop the war. The U.S. even supplying the Zionists more weapons and more, like bombs, etc., etc., It's a shame, really. The war is a shame.
And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A soldier who fights for his country. The fourth anniversary of the martyrdom of top IRGC General Qasem Soleimani, we broadcast a three-part series to introduce this well-known Iranian general to a wider public. In this program, the second of this three-part series, we focus on General Qasem Soleimani's role in the Islamic Revolution of 1978-1979 and the eight-year imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. Please stay with us. As the Islamic Revolution swept across Iran in 1978-1979, everyone was talking about the revolution and its charismatic leader. Imam Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, may God bless his soul, but in the small village of Qanat Malik in Kerman province, in southern Iran, few people had access to radio or television, and thus news of what was happening in the rest of the country was rather scarce. At that time, the young Qasem Soleimani was 22 years old. He was young, enthusiastic, and a true revolutionary, and he used to distribute photographs of Imam Khomeini among the local residents of the village, telling them about the many announcements that the Imam had made. In fact, the young Qasem Soleimani became one of the organizers and coordinators of the anti-Pahlavi regime demonstrations, protests, and general strikes in the city of Kerman in southeastern Iran. Please stay with us. Qasem Soleimani has recounted those tumultuous days of the Islamic Revolution in his personal diary, writing, "It was early 1978 and I had passed my driving test after several attempts and I was about to receive my driving license. I went to my local driving center to collect my driving license. The police officer there was named Azari Nasab and he told me to come in and sit down. Officer Azari Nasab turned to me and said, 'Your driving license is ready. You can collect it now. It has been signed by Khomeini himself.' I didn't quite get what he meant by that sarcastic remark. I was led into an empty room and two army officers entered after me and immediately started to push me around, hit me in the face and kick me. They also swore at me. I was caught in their trap and escape was impossible. After a thorough beating, I lied on the floor with a bloody nose and a bloody face. They had kicked me and punched me so badly that I was unable to move. One of the two officers then stood on my stomach and used his heavy army boots to kick my stomach so hard that it felt like all my internal organs were bleeding. I became unconscious. Despite being young and athletic and a practitioner of weightlifting and karate, I ran out of stamina and energy. I was so badly beaten, I couldn't move for 3 days. But at the end of it all, I felt a new energy surge. My fear of being beaten and tortured evaporated, and it was almost as if, with every kick and every punch I had received, the word Khomeini was etched in my mind and hacked in my soul. I became fearless and a true revolutionary. I said whatever I wanted to say and I was afraid of no one." Mata Soleimani regarded the Islamic Revolution of 1979 as a complex and deep-rooted phenomena. He always used to say that the factor which guaranteed the success of the revolution for several decades was Islam, genuine Muhammadian Islam. It was the Iranian people's firm belief in Islam which navigated them safely through the turbulent waters and made them overcome all enemy conspiracies and plots. Soon after the fall of the Pahlavi regime and the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Qasem Soleimani joined a unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC. In 1980, the 8-year imposed war on Iran started, and Qasem Soleimani and his colleagues rushed to the war front to defend the fledgling Islamic Republic and the ideals of the Islamic Revolution. They staunchly fought for their country, giving everything that they had. 8 years of sacred defense is undoubtedly one of the most important and unique chapters in Iranian history. Some of the most prominent personalities, cultural and intellectual figures of the Islamic Revolution played a part in 8 years of sacred defense. They presented to the world a special type of religious and Islamic lifestyle during the sacred defense years. Iran's soldier, Qasem Soleimani, was certainly a pioneer in the culture of sacred defense, and Soleimani played a very important role in those years of warfare. After the fall of the Pahlavi regime and the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Qasem Soleimani joined a unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the RGC, in 1979. He joined the Quds training section of the RGC headquarters in Kerman. He became an instructor at the IRGC base in Kerman. Commander Qurbani, a senior commander during the Iran-Iraq War and one of Qasem Soleimani's superior officers, recalls, "The night before the operation was due to start, and before we went to the front lines, Soleimani approached me and said, 'I must accompany my troops to the front line.' I wasn't keen on the idea and told him to substitute his second-in-command for himself. But Qasem Soleimani insisted that he wanted to accompany his forces to the front lines. And when the go-ahead for the operation was given, Soleimani and his battalion immediately attacked enemy lines and fierce fighting broke out. Qasem Soleimani's battalion managed to break through enemy lines and soon they were attacking the enemy's second line. But shortly afterwards, news of the martyrdom of the head of the battalion circulated. I dispatched several people to the front lines and told them to bring back Soleimani in any way that they could. I next met Soleimani at the Accidents and Emergency Department of Susangerd Hospital. He was lying on a bed unconscious. His right arm was badly injured by bullets and shrapnel. Some shrapnel had also entered his chest, and he was bleeding internally. I ordered an ambulance to take him to a bigger and better equipped hospital in the city of Ahwaz in southwestern Iran, where he could receive better medical treatment. About 3 weeks later, I saw him at the IRGC headquarters in Kerman. Apparently, he had been transferred from Ahwaz to a hospital in Tehran, and there they had treated the serious injuries to his right arm. But before he had time to fully recover, he decided to discharge himself from the hospital and went straight back to the front line, with his right hand hanging from a bandage to his neck. It was right then that I decided to introduce Qasem Soleimani to the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the RGC, Commander Mohsen Rezaei. I told Mohsen Rezaei, "Mr. Soleimani is both courageous and highly capable and can easily command a brigade." And sure enough, Mohsen Rezaei appointed Qasem Soleimani as the commanding officer of the Sar Allah Brigade. Qasem Soleimani was involved in many of the key operations of the 8-year war. Among them, he commanded a brigade of the Walfaj 8, Karbala 4, and Karbala 5 operations. He was injured twice during the war, one of them very seriously. Wisdom, intellect, and expediency were all highly visible in Qasem Soleimani. When it came to the enemy, he was really strong-headed and was not flexible. And he took a hard-line approach. It is common practice in wartime that senior commanders are usually stationed 20 to 30 kilometers from the troops that they command in the front lines. Very few senior commanders actually serve in the front line itself. But Haj Qasem Soleimani was a senior commander who always insisted on accompanying his troops in the front line. He was always there in the front line, in person, heading the operation that he commanded. He was a commanding officer and a real friend to all those who served under him. He knew and remembered the name of every single soldier, one of the 1,500 men who served under him. He knew the family circumstances of every single soldier who served under him, and when giving a lecture or presentation, he used to notice if one of his men was absent, and he always wanted to know the reason for this absence. Qasem Soleimani was more than just a commander. He was a true friend of every soldier who served under him.
Ocean of Dua. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the concept of supplication. We said that based on the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, there are many conditions to be met if the supplication is to be responded to. Now, we mentioned a couple of conditions, and we looked at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, which are replete with the different conditions regarding the acceptance of supplication. We were saying that since there are different constituents for a true kind of supplication, there must be different conditions regarding each of them. We said that at the very first stage, the supplicant must be sincere, and his mouth's tongue must be in harmony with his heart's tongue. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, اللهم اغفر لي ما تقربت به إليك بلساني ثم خالفه قلبي. O Allah, forgive me for what I have approached to you with my tongue, and then my heart has opposed it. Let us have a look at other instances so we can understand this point better. When Abraham, alayhi salam, was arguing with the infidels and was praising his God, he said, My God is the one who الذي خلقني فهو يهديني والذي يطعمني ويسقين وإذا مرضت فهو يشفين. My God is the one who created me. Then he showed me the way. Then he is the one who gives me to eat, gives me to drink. والذي يطعمني هو يطعمني ويسقين وإذا مرضت فهو يشفين. And he is the one that when I am sick, he restores me to health. والذي يميتني ثم يحيين. He is the one who will cause me to die and then gives me life. And who I hope will forgive me my mistakes on the day of judgment. In this verse, Prophet Abraham has ascribed to God the power of guidance and the acceptance of guidance to himself. He has ascribed feeding to God and hunger and thirst to himself. He ascribed healing to God but disease to himself. He recognizes life and death to be a loss. He knows that to err is a matter of man, but to forgive is a loss. This is the point that we are trying to establish. Then he invokes Allah by saying, رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ. That's the time when he truly asks the Almighty Allah, My Lord, grant me wisdom and join me with the good. وَجْعَلِّي لِسَانَ صِدْقٍ فِي الْآخِرِينَ. O Allah, ordain for me a goodly mention among posterity and make me of the heirs of the Garden of Bliss and forgive my father, for he is surely of those who have gone astray. So Abraham, Prophet Abraham, alayhi salam, through these words has asked God for all means of perfection. But before that, prior to that, he is clearly stating a set of conditions. We can infer those conditions from the words of Prophet Abraham. And regarding the first constituent of the supplication, which is the kind of interaction and relation between the two sides, and the second and third constituents, which is the supplicant and the Almighty Allah, we can, I assume, infer many of the conditions for these constituents. So Prophet Abraham has ascribed to God all good epithets.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you, Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
Dear listeners, one of the most significant assets God has bestowed upon His servants is the spiritual attraction which is emphasized in numerous traditions. This kind of attraction is the first constituent which constitutes the reality. The entity, the spirit of dua and supplication, is referred to as by the word dua. من أعطى الدعاء أعطى الإجابة. The one who has given you supplication will give you the response to it. That very one will respond to it. Both Sunni and Shi'i sources report from the Prophet ﷺ saying, الدُعَاءُ سِلَاحُ الْمُؤْمِنِ, that supplication is the believer's weapon. In Bihar al-Anwar, we read these traditions that say, لَا يَرُدُّ الْقَضَاءَ إِلَّا الْبَلَاءَ. Nothing causes a divine decree to be annulled except supplication. In this regard, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, supplication causes a divine decree to be annulled after it has been confirmed. الدُعَاءُ يَرُدُّ الْقَضَاءَ بَعْدَمَا أُبْرِمَ إِبْرَامَ. Practice supplication too much, فَأَكْثِرْ مِنَ الدُّعَاءَ فَإِنَّهُ مِفْتَاحُ كُلِّ رَحْمَةٍ. It is the key to every mercy, and it is the means for every need to be satisfied. وَالنَّجَاحُ كُلِّ حَاجَةٍ. Nothing of the blessings of the Almighty Allah will be gained, dear listeners, save by supplication. And this is what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says. لَا يُنَالُ مَا عِنْدَ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلِ إِلَّا بِالدُّعَاءِ وَلَيْ سَبَابٌ يَكْثُرُ قَرْعُهُ إِلَّا يُوشَكُ أَنْ يُفْتَحَ لِصَاحِبِهِ. And every door that is knocked repeatedly will be opened. Nothing of the blessings of the Almighty Allah will be gained save by supplication. This is the importance of the first constituent of supplication. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Yeah,
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
End of a blood-soaked year, start of another. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Today marks the start of the year 2024 of the Gregorian calendar, that was ushered in at midnight in the West and in societies influenced by Western culture, with depraved parties, as revelers committed the oldest sins in the newest ways, as if the goal of life is sadism and pleasures of the flesh, without the least thought for the sufferings of fellow humans, especially mass massacred and the indiscriminate bombing to death of civilians, including children and women. An adage says the object of a new year is to have a new soul, and to prepare for the present requires proper pondering on incidents of the year gone by. Wonder how many of the so-called statesmen in the West, especially of the supposedly big powers, and the U.S. in particular, have the soul and the mind to reflect on their strategic blunders of the past year that have worsened the misery of mankind. Yesterday, people in the West bade farewell to the year 2023 of the Gregorian calendar, accompanied as usual by mirth, lights, fireworks, and of course, the other depravities that have become part of life in cultures devoid of spiritual and religious values. Joe Biden, the mass murderer in Washington who fuels the flames of war in Ukraine and in October calling himself Zionist, openly supported child killer Benjamin Netanyahu's genocide in Gaza, ended the year with more unpardonable crimes, such as vetoing of UN Security Council resolutions for ceasefire and the bypassing of the American Congress for supply of multi-million dollars of lethal weapons to Israel to continue the bloodbath of the people of Palestine. With such a horrible ending, it is anybody's guess how 2024 will turn out for the world, given the satanic nature of Biden, his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, a Zionist of Ukrainian origins, and his War Secretary, Lloyd Austin, who, in his blind support for the crimes of the illegal Zionist entity, craves for the shedding of more innocent blood. These perpetrators of crimes against humanity will certainly not be left unpunished in the present year, God willing. Anyway, the year that has started also looks as gloomy and as bloody as the year that went by because of the lack of spiritual values in the West, especially in the U.S., whose state terrorism has spread all over the world, including our region, where the CENTCOM terrorists are based and ought to be kicked out for the sake of peace and stability. An important point to note is that the Gregorian calendar has no connection with Jesus or his message of peace, but is linked with the hidden heritage of ancient Rome, at which we should cast a glance. It is these pagan roots of the supposedly Christian calendar that makes the West, and wherever its decadent culture has been imposed, to indulge in crimes against humanity and to commit the oldest sins in the newest possible ways on the New Year, under cover of the creed of the most misunderstood messenger of God. Misunderstood because, at one extreme, Jesus was elevated to Godhead by the Romans who were converted to Paul's version of Christianity more than three centuries after the Messiah, and at the other extreme, the Zionists continue to shamelessly slander him and his Virgin Mother Mary, peace upon her. That is the reason the Zionists consider it the racist right to massacre the people of Palestine, while the West regards it a religiously duty to support the genocide of the people of Gaza. Both Muslims and Christians who neither slander Jesus nor his chaste mother and have the highest respect for them. As we said, the fact of the matter is that the New Year of the West has nothing to do with Christianity, let alone the monotheistic teachings of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, who, as is evident by his words in the Gospels, was sent to the lost sheep of Israel that betrayed the virgin-born Messiah and continues its crimes against humanity. The West is totally alienated from the true message of the Son of Mary. The goal of the message of the prophets is to ensure peace, prosperity, and justice in the transient life of this world and guarantee salvation in afterlife. That is the reason through them God gave laws to the human societies so that they will not follow the whims and deception of Satan to coin absurd laws of their own, as is the case with the secular societies and the weird system of liberal democracy, which is actually rebellion against God and violation of the teachings of Jesus. It would be tedious here to detail the fixing of January 1st as the new year over 2,000 years ago by the pagan ruler Julius Caesar, who ordered the change of the Roman calendar from the spring of March to the gloom of winter, not on the basis of any prophecy of the birth of Jesus, but in order to celebrate one of his bloody military victories in a part of Central Europe that had resulted in human misery such as massacre of men, rape and enslavement of women, orphaning of children and destruction of homes and hearts. Thus, January 1st is not the new year of the Christians, neither of the Jews, and certainly not of the Muslims. As a matter of fact, it has no significance for any other religion anywhere in the world, such as Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, Taoism, Buddhism, Shamanism, and even Animism. In other words, none of the religious texts of the said creeds or the principal figures, including Prophet Jesus, have said anything about the 1st of January, which decades before his birth was made the first day of the Roman calendar in 45 BC by Julius Caesar in honor of Janus, the pagan deity of beginnings and transitions, hence the naming of month as January. More than a millennium and a half later, in 1582, several centuries after the Christianizing of the Roman Empire, not on the basis of the monotheistic message of the Messiah, but as per the weird concept of Trinity coined by the Hellenized Jew Paul, Pope Gregory, following some revisions of Caesar's pagan Julian calendar, launched a new calendar in his own name on February 24th, calling it Gregorian. He, however, reverted to the pagan practice of January 1st as the start of the new year. It took several more centuries for January 1st to be accepted as the start of the new year. For instance, the Netherlands adopted the Gregorian calendar in 1698, Britain and its colonies, including what is now the United States, in 1752, Russia in 1980. After the atheist Bolshevik Revolution and Greece as late as in 1923, it was only in the 20th century between the two world wars that the Gregorian calendar, along with January 1st as New Year Day, was forced by paying lip service to Christianity, hate from the depth of their hearts, the virgin-born Messiah and his monotheistic message of peace, virtue and social justice. It is worth noting that none of the Orthodox churches, such as those based in Greece, Cyprus, Constantinople or Istanbul, Alexandria in Egypt, Antioch in Syria, Russia, Armenia, Georgia, and etc., have accepted the Vatican's imposition of the Gregorian calendar. This means, religiously, January 1st is not the New Year day for these Christian churches. In view of these undeniable facts, the new Gregorian calendar year 2024, whatever its origin, and in whatever way the West and its client regimes in the Arab world celebrate it, is not expected to bring any relief to humanity. No wonder January 1st has come to be known as the Day of Depraved because of its pagan Roman origins and the indulgence of the misled on this occasion in the most cardinal sins on which the Bible frowns upon. Presently, it is the day of the Zionist mass murderers to continue the genocide of the Palestinians with the deadly weapons and active support of the United States.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.